All right, it's recording, and you'll just, there's probably a difference. I'll be really loud, and you'll be soft, but that's your problem. Not
that'll be something new in my life. No, excuse me of being soft-spoken. All right, so let's go back to this.
All right.
So as I started to say, I don't really know much about you other than when I fell into this, that everywhere I looked, your articles seem to be paving the way on all fronts of investigative journalism, and that's when I became so attracted to your work. But I have no idea how long you've been doing this, what got you started, so I'm interested in all the entire schedule.
And I will tell you anything you want to know.
All right, so how did you get started? Because I was, when we were speaking, or when we were speaking, e-speaking the other day, or maybe mm-hmm. we were talking, actually talking, when I said, you know, I'm not a journalist, you said something to the effect of you're as much a journalist as I am. So that, of course, intrigued me.
Yep.
What does that mean? I assumed, you know, you have some journalism degree and have been doing this for 400 years.
Nope. I have no journalism degree. I haven't been, I've been doing this for, boy, just over 2 years now. And when I say doing this, I mean the Brad blog, but I wasn't even on a Brad blog. I wasn't always doing reporting, certainly not investigative reporting to the extent that I am now. I was an actor, a writer, a director, a software programmer, which interestingly enough has come in very handy with much of what I'm covering. I had
way into this.
What's that?
How did you segue into this?
Well, I had produced a show out here that had been a comedy show, actually, a Saturday night comedy show that had been very, very successful, and I worked on that for about 5 years. And it was a new show every weekend, sold out, very successful. And then finally I needed a break, so I stopped doing that. But after a while, I kind of got antsy to do something because I had, you know, been working so hard on that show every week, writing so much material and everything else. And by the way, it had a lot of political satire in it, which certainly finds its way, I think, into the Brad blog even now. But and so my girlfriend suggested I start a blog to keep myself busy. And after asking her what the hell is a blog, and she explained, I said, okay. So I set it up, but it was really just at the time a lark to keep myself busy. I was, you know, my uncle had just died. My cat was actually sick and was soon to die. So I was posting pictures of them, you know, links to Doonesbury cartoons. Really nothing particularly important. It was just sort of, you know, keeping me occupied. And I would spout off politically, which I used to do in sort of a small family email circle amongst my family of, you know, hard right Republicans. Right. And, you know, and I realized, well, geez, if I'm going to be making the case to, you know, six people in a email, perhaps I'm, you know, better spending my time, you know, putting that same information out there on the web for the whole wide world to see if they're interested. And, you know, some weren't. And it wasn't until later in the year where I started, I had noticed something after, during the vice presidential debates, really, where Edwards had claimed that, you know, had kept talking about the fact that 90% of the casualties taken in the war were taken by the Americans, as far as, you know, the coalition went. And Cheney was all indignant that what an insult that is to our Iraqi allies. And that was the first time I had heard, you know, the Iraqis referred to as allies, and this notion that they were you know, part of the member of the coalition, whatever, or the coalition of the willing. And so I went to the White House website to see if they, in fact, listed Iraq as a member of the coalition of the willing, and the link to the page was there. There was a link that said, you know, coalition members list here. You clicked on it, and it was a broken link. It went to nowhere. They had removed the list from the site. And I reported on that. And other people.
They're quickly updating us.
Well, yeah. Well, they could, at the time, there were so many people who were leaving the coalition. You know, they couldn't keep up with it. So I think it was just easier to remove the list entirely, but they didn't remove the link to it. So the evidence that it had existed was still there. But then as I sort of reported that at BradBlog, other people chimed in to say, hey, the video where Bush says at a press conference that he's not all that concerned about Osama bin Laden, that video isn't there either. And I started looking around, and all of this embarrassing audio and video was gone. And so I wrote about it, and I slapped a sensationalistic, drudge-like headline on there and called it the White House website scrubbing. Slapped up a drudge siren. This got some notice, and eventually I think was picked up in the Washington Post and other places, and reporters then asked the White House about this, and because as it turns out, I reported that you can't just remove material like that that's published by the White House. You can't just make it disappear. It's a violation of the National the Presidential Records Act of 1978. Which was instituted after Richard Nixon was.
But that hasn't seemed to stop them from doing it.
Making things go away. Well, it actually did stop them because in the week of the election, I'm quite pleased with this, because of pressure, the week of the 2004 election, the White House was forced to restore tons and tons, terabytes of audio and video to the White House website. Which I'm sure it took quite a bit of time, and the fact that it took up their precious time in the week leading up to the election was just fine by me. So at that point, you know, I started getting a lot more readership and, you know, basically continued doing exactly that, you know, reporting on things that I found interesting or curious. And then came the election itself, and, well, things kind of went crazy from there.
So when, at what point were you taken seriously, both by readers and the poaching mainstream media?
What did you call them?
They're poachers.
Okay. Why are they poachers?
That works.
Well, actually,
they either ignore you or they poach.
Yeah, exactly.
Without attributing.
Right. Well, that's true. That's what they do now. So, well, actually, I don't know what point I was taken seriously. I'm still not sure if I am taken seriously or not, certainly by the readers. But I think it was, you know, with that story that got some attention, and then came the election, and oddly enough, the, you know, immediately that night out here of November 2nd, you know, into the wee hours when things... It looked all day like Kerry was going to win, and then something happened, and he didn't. It just didn't make any sense to me. And I went to bed that night, I don't know, 3 or 4 in the morning, and said, you know, the first thing I'm going to do when I wake up is I'm going to look and compare these exit poll numbers to the states in which there is electronic voting and see if there's a difference in, you know, how they ended up swinging, if it was the states that had electronic voting.
So you saw that connection right away.
Well, I was certainly curious about it, and I was so exhausted by 3 or 4 in the morning because I had been sort of live blogging all day what was going on, you know, that I couldn't do it that night. I said, I'll wake up. That'll be my project in the morning. When I had woken up, I saw that Raw Story had already done exactly that. So I was pleased at that. And they compared, and indeed there was reasons to be concerned about the exit poll swing in swing states that had electronic voting. I knew right then that something didn't make sense. We needed to keep reporting on this. I let some of the other progressive bloggers that I had known out there, you know, I sent them a message saying, look, you know, we need to keep this in the news. We need to keep digging here, you know, rather than waiting for a week or a month until a smoking gun comes out, and then, you know, the other side, the bad guys, can say, oh, well, you see, they're just, you know, coming up with some crazy scheme. But if we keep reporting on the various anomalies that we're seeing all throughout, then it'll make sense as we uncover more and more. Well, I kept doing that, and but very few other bloggers actually did that.
How do you explain that? Why do you think they dropped it?
I don't know. I think at a certain point, once again, the bad guys, and I don't want to say Republicans because it's not necessarily it's you know, certainly not the Republican voters per se, but it's this, you know, this really evil cabal that has taken over the Republican Party, and the political operatives at the top who will do anything for power, no matter how un-American it is. I think they had done a very effective job of sort of painting those of us who were looking at these things as, you know, conspiracy theorists and tinfoil hat wearers. And this would appear in the New York Times and those sorts of places. And I think a lot of progressives, Democrats, and others just got scared. And they shouldn't have because, you know, here we are now 2 years down the road at least. And I'm quite satisfied with my reporting. I'm quite satisfied that I was right in the first place to be concerned about what was going on. And I have found really nothing but information to shore up that point since then, both about the 2004. What's that?
Look at all the time that's been lost by the mainstream or corporate media not picking this up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's sort of like you're busy. The tree falling in the forest.
Yep.
And nobody's paying attention, and then all of a sudden now they're playing a little catch up, and so much time has elapsed.
Oh, indeed. No, I mean it's devastating to our country. It's devastating to our democracy. But you know, I can't control what goes on in the corporate mainstream media. They're going to do what they want to do. All I can do is make as much noise as I can, let them know about what's going on, encourage them to report on these things. And I have, you know, done so. And I've had many folks in the mainstream media throughout all of this, and in particular right in December of 2004, after I broke the Clint Curtis story, you know, I mean, I had folks from every news organization, from, you know, Newsweek, CNN, AP, 60 Minutes, you know, they all touched base. They were all interested in the story, fascinated in the story, but they were terrified to touch it. And to a certain extent, they're still terrified to touch it, even to this day. There's either terror to touch it, or I think in some respects it may be that reporting on it now is, in essence, an admission that they've been delinquent for 2 years. So it's easier to not report it at all.
That the Rather story and that whole business made people even more wary about coming out with anything that could be construed as critical?
It absolutely did. And, I mean, speaking specifically to people at CBS, they were scared to death of that. And, you know, they were very, very interested in doing a piece on Clint Curtis. And then at some point, you know, and one of the producers even said as much to me, that the political atmosphere has changed so much that pretty much folks are scared to touch anything that can even be construed as being, you know, negative to the administration. That has definitely had an enormous effect over the entire corporate mainstream media. I mean, they have just shied away from, you know, negative stories about the administration now for 5 years. They're sort of, kind of waking up from their coma now.
But, yeah, well, it's,
but only sort of, kind of.
Yeah, right. With the popularity of the White House tanking now, do you think that the corporate media will become emboldened to voice the critical stories that have only been carried by bloggers up till now?
No.
I mean, in other words, they're not going to pop back into their old role.
I don't think they're out of their old role yet. I mean, I suspect all along, and I mean, I know this for a fact, that I would talk to reporters. There were reporters who wanted to dig into this stuff, but the higher-ups, the editors, the publishers, and the corporate attorneys and so forth didn't want them to go there. The fact of the matter is, to a large extent, they still don't want them to go there. And I've, you know, seen this right now with the several organizations, several reporters, producers who are working on very important stories related to this election reform and the Help America Vote Act and the disaster that it is, but they're not being allowed to report it because of their, the folks above them, the corporate attorneys who are just scared to death of real reporting. Look, these are now huge multi-million dollar corporations. They don't want to have another Rathergate. They don't want to have a situation like Eason Jordan at CNN, who was, you know, run out of town on a rail by the right-wing media bloggers. And so they're just, you know, they're still very, very careful about all of this. And it's terrible. And that's what you get, though, when you, you know, conglomerate everything down to, you know, five or six organizations that control the entire media. It's certainly not good for competition. And
what do you think is going to be the repercussions from Knight Ridder?
From the sale of Knight Ridder?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just one more. I mean, Knight Ridder was actually a group that did some, you know, fairly aggressive reporting,
right,
or that didn't, you know, roll over for the administration all the time. And it's just one more of the good guys, you know, has disappeared under this huge corporate banner and less reporting for the American people. Now, the upside of it is the rise of the blogs. And I think in many ways, and not just the blogs, I mean, out of the blogs, I do a radio show now, and that's come out of my work in the blogs. And so a lot of the bloggers are getting paid gigs, if you will, whether it's on radio or working for the corporate mainstream media. Mm-hmm. So we are hearing a lot more of those voices, and they're still available, whether they're, you know, in the paid media or not. They're still available. So the story is getting out. But, you know, we still need the corporate mainstream media to show up and play and to be aggressive and watchdogs for the American citizens, and they are just not doing that.
Okay. So let me ask you another aspect of this, which is, so now you have a radio show.
Yeah.
But from what I understand, it's difficult also for a progressive radio shows to get aired. For instance, Air America has had a hard time finding niches, and I know at least in Phoenix it was sort of run out initially by the right wing, and then they found another forum. How does the radio how conducive are the airwaves to getting anything progressive on?
It is still difficult, but without divulging too much of what I'm working on for the moment, not to keep anything from you, but I just not ready to announce a few things just yet. So without divulging too much, I can say I think that there is a way for progressive voices to make their way onto into the media, onto the radio, and so forth, in a similar way that the blogs have done, which is to say, sort of from the bottom up. You know, if you're presenting content that has value, has news value, I believe it will rise to the top. Now, Air America, God love them, you know, I support them, but they came in with a really bad business model. They still have, from what I understand of their business model, there's still a great deal of concerns about it, and it's sort of top-heavy. And they're actually doing quite well and adding more and more stations now, but they still have sort of a difficult business model and some difficult hurdles, therefore, to overcome. So there is a different way to do it.
The inside rather than the outside, what's plaguing them, partly.
Yeah, I think so. Now, nonetheless, however, you still have the problem. You know, I know progressive radio hosts around the country who might be on a station, one in particular, Bob Kincaid out in West Virginia. He had the only show on this particular station in West Virginia. He had the only liberal show and the only show that was completely paid for by a sponsor. And yet, the radio show host, apparently, I'm sorry, the program director at the radio station was a wingnut, didn't like what Bob had to say, and replaced him with Michael Savage.
And what?
Well, did you say, and then what?
Yeah.
Well, then he's been fighting his way back onto the air ever since, and hopefully I'll be able to put some things in place that will help help him do exactly that and help a lot of other progressive radio hosts around the country to get their voice up and out there in such a way that, you know, people can find it the way they find the web, the way they find the blogs when they're interested. You know, go out and look for that material, and then I think that will then begin to rise to the top and make its way into the corporate media the way the blog reporting has.
All right, I have another question and another take altogether.
Okay.
It sounds to me that at any given time you have a number of stories. It's sort of like when you're cooking and you have some on the front burner and some that are percolating on the back burner.
Yeah.
It sounds like there's a lot of stuff going on.
You're correct.
As a journalist, how do you juggle all these stories, and it seems to me like it would be tremendously complicated.
It is. It is tremendously complicated. It's incredibly hard. It's made even more difficult because, you know, there's no news bureau here. There's no agency. It's pretty much just me. I use the royal we a lot in my stories, that, you know, we at the Brad blog have found this or that. So people presume that there's a team of people here. Right. Nope, it's pretty much just me. So it's really hard to keep up, and it's even harder to keep up because guess what? There ain't nobody paying me. You know, we do okay on advertisements, and, you know, I beg and plead when I can for donations, but frankly they're few and far between. So it's really, really difficult to pay for all this. I was doing much better prior to getting into this. Believe it or not, you know, people talk about acting, you know, have a fallback career. Guess what? Acting is my fallback career to journalism because I was doing better as an actor financially in any case. But I think that the work that I'm doing, until other folks step up and do it, until the mainstream media who ought to be doing this steps up and does this stuff, I have to keep doing it. But it is hard.
I feel like it's more like a mission, in other words, because you're certainly not doing it for the moolah.
Certainly not for the moolah, that's for sure. And, I mean, calling it a mission sounds too altruistic or something. I think it's – I just feel that it's important, and I feel that in many cases there's stories that if I don't tell them, they won't get out there, period. Don't know if I'm fooling myself or not.
That sounds like a mission. I mean, I'm not trying to make you into a saint,
mm-hmm.
but, I mean, in terms of – you can't help yourself, in a sense. You know, you see it,
yep.
and you feel compelled to deal with it because
yep.
whatever, that nobody else is doing it or
right.
the need to have the public know.
Exactly right.
So,
but, you know, I think that's why you're doing what you're doing.
I agree.
You know, unless you're making a whole bunch of money and I hadn't realized it, you're probably doing it because you realize that it's important and that you have to make noise. And you have to sort of fight back if you want to take your country back because, you know, this democracy is not going to save itself. So we're all in this mess together. So you started out by asking me, you know, by talking about, you know, the fact that I said, hey, you know as much about this as I do. It's really true. You know, the citizen journalist right now is in many ways saving this country. And it's important for folks like you to be the media. I say that, you know, at the top of my blog up there, I think it says, be the media because someone's got to. And, you know, until the real media, I guess, steps up and does their job, it's left to folks like you and I. But, you know, democracy demands vigilance. And so right now we have to be vigilant and take back our country from this unprecedented corrupt, and I was going to say administration, but no, it's an entire network, an entire insidious and tentacled, spidering network of opportunists who have hijacked this country and this government and one, at least one political party, for their own personal pleasure and greed. And it is remarkable, and it is destroying not just this country, but in many cases the world as we edge towards World War III, because these jerks are just so irresponsible.
I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
I figured you might be.
So then how do you try to measure the impact that you're making, the way that you're able to get the word out, or do you not bother with that? I mean, what kind of, you know, overview do you take here?
Ask me that again, because I'm not sure I understand.
Okay. So, I mean, I think that in certain ways what we're doing, we're sort of like in parallel play, you know, when you have two-year-olds who are doing, they're sitting side by side, they're doing similar things side by side, so it's called parallel play.
Okay.
So in many ways, you and I, although we're not doing the same thing, our motivation is similar, what we're trying to accomplish in terms of bringing things to the public are similar. So I'm extrapolating, because to me, I am constantly flipping between taking a long view, getting extremely frustrated, you know, thinking that, you know, I used to, at the beginning of this, wake up, I thought this was very symbolic, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd have a sore throat, because I always felt like I was screaming and nobody could hear me.
Huh.
So I'm wondering, for you, especially since this also is not, it's a chosen field, it's not your profession per se, how, if you spend any time trying to measure progress, you know, how you measure if you're making an impact, who's listening out there, or if you just put that all aside and just keep on sort of doing that marathon with putting one foot in front of the other.
Well, okay, good question. It's interesting. Well, first let me say that I think that you and I are doing the same thing, which is to say making noise, trying to you know, help people understand and be aware of just what exactly is going on in their democracy. And there is nothing, by the way, and I've seen some of your columns that you wrote recently, there is nothing that keeps you from doing exactly what I'm doing, which is when you find something that is interesting, that is notable, that needs to be talked about, and that needs to be reported, from, you know, talking about it, reporting it. So what you and I do is, frankly, not very much different. That said, I mean, yeah, I have to, unfortunately, it's right now, by and large, you know, advertising and donations that are going to pay my rent. So I do have to keep an eye on traffic to my website, to bradblog.com, which, you know, I hope is going up, because that allows me to raise ad prices and hopefully make some more money. That said, there's a whole bunch of things I could be doing on the website that would bring me a hell of a lot more traffic, but I don't do them because that's not really what it's about. But as far as, you know...
For instance, I have no idea, you know, since I'm new to this, I barely know what a blog is. Like what? What are you talking about?
As far as what could I do?
Yeah, that you've purposely chosen not to do.
Well, you know, the type of stories you choose. I mean, there are certain stories that you know. For example, if I write a story about, if I merely mention the words Ann Coulter on my website, hits will go through the roof. Traffic will go through the roof because everybody loves her so much on the right, they want to come over and see how I'm bad-mouthing her. And on the left, they hate her so much, they want to see what I'm bad-mouthing about her. Yeah, exactly. So, frankly, I could cover something about Ann Coulter every day, and it would probably send traffic through the roof. But I don't. I only cover it when I feel there's really something newsworthy, and I have something to offer. As well, you'll note there's a lot of other blogs who have much more traffic than I do, and they do, you know, very little or no actual original reporting. So if all I wanted to do was be sort of a classic blog, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just not what I do. You know, I could link to a lot of other sites, you know, little one-liners. Hey, check this thing out, and, you know, click here. That really works well for traffic. And a lot of blogs have done so very successfully doing exactly that. But I don't do that. I don't want to just be a portal to other places. I've been trying to do original reporting and original news, which, you know, means I might only be able to get out one or two stories a day, and because they have a lot more detail and they take a lot more time.
Of course.
And that's not necessarily
that in terms of the amount of time you spend doing this.
I'm sorry?
Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
How much time do you actually spend on a story? How many hours a day do you spend doing this? Do you have a life other than that?
Not much of one anymore. I mean, it's really 24/7 now. I and I'm almost not exaggerating that. I mean, some nights I'm going to bed at 4 and 5 in the morning, and you know, sleep with you or something. I try to find a life other than this, but sometimes it doesn't work out so well. Last summer, I finally, got some guest bloggers in, was going to get the hell off the grid entirely, go camping, my girlfriend and I, up in the mountains in Nevada, and I was successful at that for about 2 nights, I think, and I had no cell phone coverage, no internet, it was great, and then I made the mistake of pulling out an old transistor radio and hearing this scratchy radio signal of Rush Limbaugh lying about Cindy Sheehan down there in Crawford, Texas, who had just set up camp down there. And I said to my girlfriend up there in the middle of nowhere, I think we need to go to Texas and try to get on the air and try to broadcast what's really going on the ground in Crawford. And, of course, we had no idea how to do it, how to broadcast from the middle of a cow pasture down there. But we said, well, we'll figure that out on the way, because we had a long drive across the country to get there. And, in fact, we did figure it out, and, in fact, we did go up, and we started doing a radio show. Until then, I had been doing just a Saturday show, but we did a daily show every day for about 2 weeks straight until they packed up and left. We did some 50-plus hours. Some days we were doing 8 or 9 hours a day on the radio. At one point, Air America came and simulcast with us. So that was the last time I tried to get a vacation. You see how that worked out.
But how do you, I mean, again, I'm extrapolating from my own life, and mm-hmm. I also have a real life job and a
yeah.
family, and I'm doing this, and I'm also doing my lending library project.
Right.
There are plenty of times when I'm on way too late,
mm-hmm.
go to bed way too late, and I'm crabby with my family,
yeah.
whatever else, and I'm thinking that long term, it's not necessarily a healthy prescription. So the
no.
question is, can you do something like what you're doing at the rate you're doing it and not burn out spectacularly because you just run out of steam?
Yeah, no, I don't think you can, which is why I am looking at various changes to be made to accommodate for just that. Again, don't want to go into details. All of them, I think, you know, will ultimately be good all around because it'll allow me to do a lot more without having to, you know, kill myself and burn myself out that way. It is really hard, but you know what? I see this all over the place. I see this in the election reform movement like crazy. I see, you know, people filing bankruptcy. I see people getting divorced.
Things overextended?
Yeah, well, I think they, you know, these are people, these are great American patriots who really give a damn about this and see what's going on here. And it's, once you see what's going on, it's hard to not do anything about it, as you know. It's hard to sit there and just say, well, we'll let somebody else handle it. No, you have to, in many cases, do something. But, you know, it's such a difficult fight. We are so much David. They are so much Goliath at this point that it really does, you know, burn people out and break up marriages and everything else. And it's really costly and it's really difficult. It's really hard. So I don't blame anybody if they say, you know what, I have to get the hell out of this thing, or I have to do a little bit less because I'm getting, you know, burnt out. But, you know, I also understand the other side of the coin that, you know, like you suggested, you know, you feel you have to do something. So how do you balance the two?
Right. That's a tough toughie.
It is tough. But how do you not do anything? You say you have kids. How old are your kids?
My youngest is 16, and I have two 25-year-olds who are going to be 26 in June.
Okay. Well, maybe they'll get lucky and escape the draft at their ages. But how can you look at this, see what is being done to a world, and the kids that will be endangered by this and have to continue fighting these stupid wars because of irresponsible jerks like those we have running this country? How can you look at that and not do something and not realize you have to do something?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I feel that I'm doing this because of my children.
I'll tell you two things that sort of keep me going, that sort of drive me. My grandfather, when World War II broke out, he ended up going out and joining up at, 34 years old or 38 or something like that, and he had already had a business. He had two kids, and but felt that he needed to do something at that point for the country. Now, I was born in a time after the draft had occurred and, had been ended. I was never up for the draft or anything else. I have never in my life felt a calling to my country until now. And when I see people that are getting killed, and like I said, down in Crawford, talking to the troops who had just returned home from Iraq, seeing what they had gone through, if they can stay out there for 1, 2, 3 years at a time, and they have families, and a lot of them are not kids, they're called up, they've got family. If they can do that because they have no choice, because they're ordered to do so, then the least I can do is stay up a few extra hours and exhaust myself if that's what happens, And then when I wonder why the hell am I doing this. Why the hell am I up? It's 3 a.m. I'll suddenly get an email in my box from somebody in Iraq who's a fighter pilot or something. There was a helicopter pilot who contacted me and, said, "Brad, thank you for what you're doing. Keep doing it." And, I got a note like that, I remember, not all that long ago in the middle of the night when I was exhausted and I just sort of started crying, just broke down. And I was reminded, okay, that's why I'm doing it. Until it's over there and over here, I need to keep doing it, I guess.
All right. Can we go on another tack? Are you running out of steam?
I never run out of steam. We go anywhere you want, Jim.
All right, cool. All right. So first of all, how old are you actually?
39.
How old?
39.
Okay. So you're like a different generation than I am, almost.
Am I?
Well, I'm in 56.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, okay. I want to talk about John Graham and the Giraffe Project. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
What'd you call it?
John Graham is a very cool guy.
Giraffe Project?
Giraffe. He honors individuals who stick their necks out for the common good, often at risk to themselves. All kinds. He's got a great website. He used to work for the government. In fact, the way I ran across him initially was a couple years ago when I were driving up to camp to visit my son. There was something in the paper. He had written an op-ed piece about how he used to work for the government. He now does this Giraffe Project, and he somehow got on the no-fly list.
Uh-huh.
He was writing about what it's like when you get caught in that mechanism and can't get out.
Wow.
And then I explored and went to his website and read about the different individuals that a lot of just, average persons in small communities who have done great things. So I got in touch with him because of my lending library project, and he has a copy of Invisible Ballots, and, we were talking back and forth. And then one time when we were talking, he said, you should get somebody to nominate you to be a giraffe.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, at this point, the only danger to me is of my butt getting too sore from sitting at the computer. And he said, as you get more involved and deeper, you will ruffle feathers and then, you know, keep this in the back of your pocket.
Yeah.
Your back pocket. So then, you know, I now have a network of people who are voting activists or activists of other sorts, and I told the story, and a number of people said, oh, yes, you know, we've been had our phones tapped for years and various things to that effect. And I'm wondering if you, since you certainly are ruffling feathers in a much more extensive way than I am, if you have felt Big Brother breathing down your neck, and if you felt that you're being observed or whatever else, you know, does that resonate for you?
Well, I'll tell you, I just presume whenever I'm on the phone and I, you know, tell this to people, presume when you're talking to me that somebody is listening. Do I know if they are? No, I don't. Have I had some, you know, very bizarre things happen to me on the phone and odd, you know, things that I've been warned to listen for, clicks and other odd behavior? Yeah, happens to me all the time. So I just assume, I presume that's going on. That said, if we worry about that, and I say this to people all the time, if you worry about that, then the terrorists have won.
Immobilizing.
What's that?
It's immobilizing.
Well, yeah, you can't, you know, people say, oh, we better not do this, we'll get in trouble. You know, you have to do it, and, you know, just be smart, be careful, watch your back, lock your doors. I can tell you that I've never been more terrified in my life than I was when I initially broke the Clint Curtis story back in December of 2004, you know, just not even a month after the election, and you know, the most volatile political period this country perhaps has ever gone through, and I'm about to come out with a story that says, you know, this election may have been rigged. It may go all the way to the top. One guy is already dead involved with this story under incredibly suspicious circumstances. The day that I broke the story, I had helped to get Clint Curtis up to Washington, D.C. to tell his story to Congress, and about 3 hours after I reported this, after we broke the story at Bradblog, his dog down in Florida, his dog was shot. I had been up for literally 3 days in a row at that point. I didn't even know you could stay up for 3 days in a row, but I was so creeped out by this entire story. Seriously, by the third night, I was like praying to fall asleep, but I couldn't. You know, when I heard about his dog, you know, being killed again, same thing, you know, I kind of fell apart, and wondered, oh, is that my fault? Did I screw up? You know, and in the weeks and months after that, it was really scary, because he's had a lot of death threats against him, and, you know, and I began to get death threats, and so I locked my doors and watched my back and everything else, but, you know, I figured if this guy could do it, if this guy could go on for the number of years that he's gone on, facing the number of things that he's faced, you know, me, some, you know, jerk writer in a smoky little office in Los Angeles, you know, I can keep it up too. And just, you know, be careful and keep telling the story. And so that's what I've done.
What's happening with that story? I mean, so he testified before Congress. I haven't noticed it becoming a big brouhaha.
Well, I mean, there's been quite a bit of coverage, and I'm actually working on a book now about it, if I can find the time to,
in your spare hours.
Yeah, I got quite a few things like that. But he's running for Congress, you know.
Yeah, I know that. But
so
what I'm saying, who's talking about his story?
Well, I still am, and because he's running for Congress now, other people are beginning to pick up his story finally.
Does he have credibility? Are people just assuming he's, you know, some jerky upstart because he's running against a guy who's an incumbent who has been in there for a long time and has survived the fact that he testified before Congress?
Well, no. As far as his story goes, look, he filed a sworn affidavit.
Right, I know.
Gave sworn testimony on videotape to Congress. He has passed a polygraph test. I have been all over his story for more than a year and a half trying to find a hole in it. I haven't been able to. There was so much attention to this story when it originally broke. You can bet the bottom dollar if there was reason to suspect, you know, there was a problem with this, it would have come out, you know, on the internet, because believe me, the wing nuts were all over this story trying to find holes in it. And, you know, so far this thing has stood up for, you know, at least a year and a half.
With it? Is Feeney being investigated? You know, I mean, in other words, it's sort of like...
No, of course not. I mean, okay. the president of the United States has admitted he broke the law. He's admitted to an impeachable offense, and nobody's even investigating him either. So, you know, it's not a surprise that all, you know, that these guys continue to get away with it. So all you can do, though, is, you know, keep pounding, keep trying to hold them accountable, keep trying to tell the stories. And in Clint's case, you know, he's done just about everything he can, short of running for Congress against this guy to help get the story out there. So guess what? Now he's running for Congress against this guy to help get the story out there.
So
and
you think that the press will then use his running, you know, in other words,
yeah,
they can paint anything they want anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So will they frame that, will they steamroll right over it, or will they really cover it and give people some understanding of what's really going on?
I think if he can, first he has to win the primary, but if he can win the primary and go head-to-head against Tom Feeney, it's an incredibly... I mean, you know, if you looked at the story at all, I mean, it's such a thrilling story, for want of a better word, that you can't not pay attention to it. Now, I'm working on a book about that, and I'm trying to expedite that since he's running for Congress, so I think it'll be quite useful for reporters and folks who are just jumping into the story. There's also a documentary filmmaker who has made a documentary film about he and I. My coverage of the story and so forth, that will hopefully be coming out this year as well. So I think it's going to get harder and harder, and in particular if he's going up against Tom Feeney in a general election for a, you know, seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, it's going to get hard for them to ignore the story. And, you know, hopefully they will begin telling it, and hopefully the more it's told, the more people will also look into it themselves, find additional material, and some of the folks who are related to the story may start talking a little bit more than they are now, folks who were there.
My skeptical side,
yep.
I'm sure you're surprised to hear I have a skeptical side.
You?
Looks at this and says, right, you know, like there's really going to be a fair election in Florida, which has now outlawed paper ballots altogether, and they're, you know, in the midst of
mm-hmm.
huge giving over to the electronic voting machine companies.
Yeah.
So it's hard to imagine that even if he had a chance, that in reality when they start counting the votes, that the votes would reflect that.
Well, you're right. You have every reason to be concerned about that and to be skeptical of that, and as am I. But try to separate your skepticism from cynicism. Skepticism is good, cynicism not so much. And, you know, to that end, we have to do what we can. If ultimately
no, of course.
It's not successful, then, you know, at least we have done everything that we can do. And if he can turn out folks in such numbers, and if folks can take an interest in this story and support this guy, he's going up against, even without the questionable voting machines and everything else they have down there, he is in a district that was carved out by Tom Feeney himself when he was Speaker of the House for himself. It's very conservative, and he is wired in, Feeney is wired in to, you know, the top order political right-wing machinery, the Tom DeLay, Jack Abramoff network, to the very top. I mean, if you look at his financial campaign, financial contributors, they mirror Tom DeLay's almost exactly. Tom Feeney was on one of those trips, by the way, to Scotland to play golf. With Ney and Tom DeLay. And here's Tom Feeney, he's the one that people don't even realize. I don't know how he's skirted it so far. But he was right there with them, and he's, you know, no, and nobody knows that. So, you know, all we can do is keep telling the story, keep telling the truth, and, you know, hope for the best and hope that they come out in such numbers that even Tom Feeney can't game the election down there. But if he does and Clint Curtis is on the ballot, he has, as a candidate, a certain standing thereafter, you know, to look at what happened and to audit those machines and those audit logs and try to expose what has happened, if there is any funny business. Not that Tom Feeney would ever do any such thing.
No, of course not. But that, there's a very analogous situation in Ohio with Petrakis and Blackwell.
Yep.
So that will be, I'm hoping that not just his own, you know, free press, but that the other Ohio media will pick up and talk about the issues which Petrakis as a candidate can bring up.
Well, I hope that they do. But, you know, I think if you talk to Bob, I think even he knows, you know, it's unlikely he's actually going to win that contest. But
I don't think he's running so that he can win.
Exactly. It's for the standing. He'll have the standing to then be able to contest it and, you know, dig a little bit deeper. And, you know, all we can do is keep peeling away at the onion. And it's a really big onion. But, you know, if we keep peeling it away and peeling it away, then hopefully we'll get at the truth of this. Of this matter and what's going on here, and finally affect some change.
Well, not only that, but it also beats being cynical and apathetic.
Yeah, and depressed. I mean, that was the one thing that I know that a lot of folks were really, really depressed, you know, on November 3rd, 2004, when John Kerry didn't win. Well, I was never depressed. What's that?
Why?
Because I was immediately, well, for one, I didn't vote for him, but that's not why I was depressed. It was because I went to work immediately. I have been digging into this damn story, you know, since 3 a.m. November 3rd, and I haven't stopped, and I haven't really even had time to become depressed and sad about it. It's, you know, I've been working on it. I've been investigating it. So that's where I put my energy. Instead of, you know, becoming depressed and...
That's much better. It's much more constructive.
Theoretically.
No, really.
It's certainly more constructive. Is it more healthy? I don't know. But it certainly proved to be more constructive.
Well, the problem, I don't know, because I for several months after the election, every night I would, after I finally went to bed, I would lie there with those cartoon, great big eyes, wide open eyes, bloodshot eyes, and just stare at the ceiling and think, oh, my God, what is happening with this country? We're so screwed.
Yep.
You know, and I actually couldn't go to sleep because it was so disturbing to me.
Yeah.
And you can't keep that up forever.
No.
Because you just collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You have to do something about it.
Right. That's what I think. So of all these stories that have drawn you in,
mm-hmm.
what would you say has been the one that you felt you sunk your teeth the most into and that has been the most satisfying to examine and pick apart?
Well, as far as specific stories go, it would probably certainly have to be the Clint Curtis story, just because I've been telling it now and reporting on it now for so long, and there's so many, again, hate to use this word, but thrilling aspects of it, you know, with Chinese spies and, you know, the connections all the way up to the White House and a dead guy in the middle.
Who's the dead guy?
Who's the dead guy?
Yeah.
Oh, boy, you don't know about Ray Lemmy?
I don't think so.
All right, I'll send you.
I need to go back and look for some of your old.
I'll send you a link that will scare the crap out of you. But basically, my pleasure. That's what I do. part of this story involves Ray Lemmy was worked out of the Inspector General's office in Florida, and Clint Curtis went to him with his story back in 2000, and. Lemmy was the one who was investigating all of Clint's claims. And in June of 2003, Lemmy came to Clint, as Clint tells it, and says, my report on this is going to be ready soon. I think you're going to be happy. Keep your ears open. The corruption goes all the way to the top. That was mid-June 2003. July 1, 2003, Ray Lemmy was found dead in a Valdosta, Georgia motel room. The police ruled it a suicide and said that they took photographs at the scene, but due to a failure in the camera's flash memory, there would be no photographs from the scene. That is, until about, early 2005, when, guess what, we posted on the Brad blog.
Photos?
Yeah.
Where did we get these photos?
They came from the Valdosta police. It turns out, what's that?
Well, I thought they didn't have any.
Yeah, well, that's what we all thought. It turns out that, apparently, back in December of 2004, as the Valdosta police told me, and mind you, Ray Lemmy was working, and Clint were working down in Tallahassee, Florida, not up in Georgia. And Valdosta is sort of a town near the border. It's about 40 minutes away from Tallahassee. And when Clint first told me the story, I asked him, well, why would Ray Lemmy be in Georgia at all? And Clint said, well, in Georgia, there are no mandatory autopsy laws. Had he committed suicide in Florida, there would have been a mandatory autopsy. Up in Georgia, no such thing. And, in fact, Ray Lemmy's body was cremated a few days later.
How convenient.
Yeah. And, I mean, there's all sorts of aspects. Once you see the pictures and once you look at the police report, all sorts of inconsistencies that just don't add up at all.
Is anybody looking at this?
Yeah, well, I am.
All by your lonesome.
And a few scores of thousands of others on the Internet. As a matter of fact, when we ran those photographs, and I reported that the police had told me that due to, quote, interest on the Internet in December of 2004, they reopened the case briefly, and that is when they claimed they were able to get at those photographs after all. And they kept it open until they received a phone call from the Florida Department of Transportation. And then they shut the case shortly thereafter. I don't know what they were told, and I don't know who they spoke to at the Florida Department of Transportation. They promised to let me know, but then suddenly they stopped talking to me altogether.
So do you still try to keep in touch with them to find out what's that, or you've been shut down?
Well, to a certain extent, I'm shut down, but I continue to press through as much as I can. Unfortunately, that story is just one of so many that I'm covering, but it also sort of gave me a reputation as, you know, someone who will cover whistleblowers and who will, you know, respect sources, and so I do cover, you know, a lot of such whistleblowers, because I think people have confidence in me that you know, I'll tell their story accurately, and I'll certainly respect them as sources for information they don't want to get out at all, like, you know, sometimes their identity completely. Sometimes they have to remain anonymous.
What's happening with Stephen Heller?
You know what? I'm actually supposed to be working on a story about him for Hustler, of all places. But I haven't been able to look into it recently, so I'm not sure where that case is right now. But that's, yeah, another example of a, you know, an incredible story of a whistleblower trying to do the right thing in America in 2006 and being and having the bad guys ruin their lives because of it. It's remarkable.
What do you think about the whole Sancho thing in Leon County, where it looks like now Diebold will in fact be selling the machines to Leon County after all that?
I will answer that question. It happens to me all the time. I got so much stuff that people send me.
All right, but you actually would watch this?
Sure, why wouldn't I?
I don't know, because you...
Does it suck? I what?
When will you find the time?
How long is it?
50 minutes.
I'll find the time.
Okay. What's your address?
It's on the front of the website, actually. You'll just see it on the front right of the website. It's a P.O. box.
Let me go there. I'll pack it up now as we speak.
Okay.
Number 244.
Your question was, what, about ion? What was
yeah.
the question? What was the specific question?
Okay, the specific question was
mm-hmm.
that what happened
mm-hmm.
was after he blew the whistle,
yeah.
then everybody tag-teamed him.
Right.
Okay, so...
Oh, and that the county is actually maybe doing business with Diebold now after all.
Yeah, that Diebold has agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the question, so I wrote, the reason I'm asking you this is because when I read this,
uh-huh.
I was very disturbed, and I wrote him saying, because I had been in contact with him before.
Right.
And I said, you know, what does this mean exactly to Leon County voters? You know, he knew that, he actually was my first local hero.
Uh-huh.
He knows that, you know, I'm impressed with what he's done and on behalf of both Florida voters and American voters.
Yeah.
But, you know, the question is, what's going on here? What does this mean? And he wrote me back and said that what he seemed to be saying was that he didn't have, although he is working for fair elections, there's a certain amount that he cannot do, that he doesn't have control over.
Well, that's true. By law, and Florida law is very specific, you know, he has to do business with one of the, right now, just three companies that are
certified to do. Well, what happened
to the
fourth one that he was, it was a bunch of initials.
Yeah, IVS,
right,
which is a phone thing.
Did they ever get certified?
You know what, I haven't heard one way or another, so I'm presuming they're still in the certification process.
Well, it'll be long enough, so it'll be a moot point.
Yeah, well, you're right. It might be. Although, here the good side is, and I happen to know this because of Clint's campaign, but Florida primaries aren't until September 5th, I believe
yeah.
it is. So there's actually a pretty good long time versus some states and counties that are having primaries right now.
Yeah, but they've been able to stall things. I know that there was one company that was trying to get certified for months and months and months, and nothing happened.
Yeah.
You know, so
oh yeah, no, they can certainly game it, and they can take forever, or they can, you know, just go ahead and say, oh no, we don't certify it. So that one's still open ended. Who knows where that's going to go? I mean, in the meantime, it took ION, you know, threatening to sue Diebold because they still have a contract with him. So, in truth, they have to do business or, you know, somehow get out of the contract.
Although it sounded to me like what they were trying to do by all the companies sort of banding together, they were trying to get him forced out so that they could then do whatever they wanted.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. And they may still be successful at that, depending on how things move ahead, but... I think that the Secretary of State down there realized, as far as I can tell, maybe I'm just being optimistic, but realized that they really don't have a leg to stand on as far as, you know, blaming Sancho for the fact that the three companies won't do business with him. I mean, it's their responsibility to do business, at least Diebold's responsibility to do business with them. He didn't break any contract, as far as I know, by allowing people to come in and hack the machines.
But they tried to paint it as if that were the case.
Oh, they tried to, but remember, he's an elected official. So, you know, it's not like he's appointed. It's, you know, they can't just fire him. He's been elected by the voters of Volusia County, and the Volusia
yeah.
County voters are hopping mad. They had a council meeting, and I spoke with ION on the air not too long ago. And he said, you know, he thought that if the Republicans on the council said one more negative thing about him, he thought that the crowd was just going to rush the stage and take these people down. So
he also got a unanimous vote of confidence from the county board.
Yeah, that was right, exactly the commissioners, and that was the meeting that I was talking about.
Right.
I think that the couple of folks on that commission did not want to vote for. to give him this vote of confidence, but realized if they didn't, they might not get out of that town hall alive. So that's how many supporters he had down there, and how the voters seemed to have his back. And the story has been picked up nationally because it's had reverberations all around the country, and so I'm happy to see that, you know, it made it into the Washington Post and other places. They actually reported fairly inaccurately on this particular story. So
it's, Miami Herald did a good job.
Yep.
With several articles.
Herald, Post, New York Times is still AWOL on the entire matter. But the Post did a nice job. I think the LA Times picked up. A lot of papers picked it up. AP certainly picked up a lot of it. Tallahassee Democrat has been particularly good on reporting that story. So there are some, you know, some folks that are doing it. But by and large, I mean, the problem with so much of this and so much of the current electoral meltdown that's going on, or as John Gideon calls it, the train wreck, is that the local media reports it as if it's a local story. There is a lot of coverage, finally, about all of these things, but they're in local papers. And, you know, they report these things, you know, in Summit County, Ohio, when the memory cards fail on the ES&S machines, as if this is something that they discovered in Summit County, and that's the only problem, and if they fix the cards, everything will be fine. But they're failing all over the country.
Well, the
national media is not getting into the game and connecting all the dots and saying, look, this is not just going on in Summit County, Ohio. It's going on in North Carolina, and it's going on in Texas, and, you know, and connecting all of those dots. And that's what we try to do at, you know, BradBlog, is to connect all of these disparate dots and say, look, we have an epidemic here. These are not local stories. This is a national story. And, you know, still waiting for the national media to get into the game the way that they ought to. But until they do, I'll be there.
What do you think has to happen to get the non-bloggers to sit up and take this seriously?
Oh, there's a lot of things that could happen that would change.
Maybe a total meltdown at the election?
That'll work.
Yeah, but what happens as a result of that?
Well, we get into a constitutional crisis, and I mean that's what we're seeing now. It's a strange feeling because I'm, you know, both happy and sad. You know, I see we've had, you know, 2 out of 50 primaries so far. Both have been unmitigated disasters in Texas and then in Illinois. I'm not happy about that. On the other hand, I think that's what it's going to take for the media to realize, and for the political parties, and hell, for the progressive blogger, for any of the bloggers to realize there's a problem out there.
All right, so two things. One thing, I know from living in Cook County myself, that most of the coverage has framed it not as an unmitigated disaster at all, but as a manpower issue,
right?
Which I think is a big misreading.
Yep.
So that's a problem, that there's coverage, but they don't necessarily look at it at the same time. And another aspect which is very troublesome about Cook County is that one of our aldermen went crazy about the whole Venezuelan connection to Sequoia, and totally took over a televised county board meeting and went off on that. And then the guys who were going to stand up and actually talk from the Illinois Ballot Integrity Project about what really was going on, by the time they stood up to speak, they either didn't get a chance at all or nobody was even in the room anymore except for the cleaning lady.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, you point to Illinois. That's actually a good example when you ask, well, what, you know, is going to happen to change things. Look, what happened down there in Illinois, the fact that wingnuts are now suddenly concerned about private ownership of our public elections and the private ownership of these companies that run them, because they discovered that Hugo Chavez may have something to do with the Sequoia Voting Systems Company, that's fine by me.
Yeah, but they're only worried about that one. They're not worried about the other ones, which happen to be privately owned and they're owned by Republican big major donors who have pledged victory to the incumbent.
Sure. Well, a path is built one stone at a time. So as soon as they discover, Hugo Chavez having control of our elections might be a problem, then that gives us an opportunity to say, yeah, it's not just a problem that Hugo Chavez can control an election. It's a problem that any private individual or corporation can own our public elections and have that much control over it. So if you're that worried about Hugo Chavez in Illinois, you ought to be that worried about Wally O'Dell in Ohio. And I think ultimately it will serve to underscore the point that election reformers like you and me have been trying to make, which is that this is no good when we open the door to this kind of thing. We're giving away our public democracy, which is the very core. The vote is the very core of our democracy. So I'm fine, and I don't mind fanning the flames of the wing nuts who are suddenly outraged about Hugo Chavez owning Sequoia in some fashion.
Wouldn't it be very ironic if the issue came to the fore because of flipping out about that, and that the Democrats have been so AWOL on this?
Yep.
And
it will. That is what will make the difference. It will be when a Republican gets his ox gored, no pun intended, by the electoral system. Suddenly, everyone's going to be concerned about it. And that's why it was important when the Republican Supreme Court justice down in Texas.
Oh, in Tarrant County.
In Tarrant County. Yeah, well, he ran across the state, but, yeah, in Tarrant County, they had 100,000 votes.
Extra votes.
It came from nowhere.
He was contesting. Or did he contest in the end?
Yeah, he did, and he filed his contest.
So
it only recently came to an end for now, because they're only given in Texas a 9-day window. And I spoke with his spokesman, Steve Smith's spokesman, who said, he has no doubt that had they had the proper time to go through all of this, they would have found that Steve Smith won the state.
So
but they don't get 3 months. What's that?
So that's the end of the story?
For now, it might be.
Uh-huh.
One thing that happened was we, now have a couple of spokespeople who are Republicans, who are conservative, who are from Texas, who are Supreme Court justices, who understand what the hell is going on here and realize that they didn't stand a chance. Because they were given 9 days, and they had no idea what to look for with these machines. In the old days, you had a paper ballot. You can go, recount the ballots and find out what you got. These guys had to bring in all kinds of experts. They had to learn how these electronic voting machines even work. And they're all different in all the different jurisdictions. And it's almost impossible to do any kind of audit. And they have learned that, and they have learned the dangers of this electronic voting. So what I'm told is the Texas legislature will be coming back into session soon, and they actually hope to use this to set up hearings in the Texas legislature so that he can testify as to, what happened in his race, and tell them. In one county, he received 0 votes, a county that 4 years ago, he won by 75%.
It should ring some alarm bells.
It should, and because it's a Republican, maybe people will pay attention, and the media along with it will pay attention. So it's going to take stories like that, I'm sorry to say, for this to get out there.
Well, good. Let Republicans understand that it doesn't play to their favor necessarily either.
No, it doesn't, and this is not a, I say it all the time, it's not a matter of right and left. This is a matter of right and wrong. This is not a partisan issue, period.
All right, so 2 more things.
Yep.
And then I got to go. My kid's been waiting to talk to me. One is Maryland. Because Maryland is sort of a flipped case with the Republican governor coming out for paper ballots.
Right.
The House unanimously, I think 137-0,
that's right,
coming out, and then it being stymied by Democrats in the Senate. And now it's a lost issue.
Is it lost?
Yeah, that's what I understand.
Did they kill it? The Senate killed it?
That's what I understand.
Really?
It was and a couple of Democrats.
Hmm.
Who apparently are tied up with Diebold.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. Linda Lamone is a Democrat. She's
right.
The elections director there up in Maryland. Down in Georgia, you got Kathy Cox, who's a Democrat. She was the champion for Diebold down there. I mean, which only underscores, you know, my point. It's not a left or right issue. And again, that story up in Maryland got a lot more attention, again, because it was the Republican governor. You know, as long as the Republicans do it, the media will pay attention. If the Democrats say something...
The bottom line is nothing happened. And two disturbing things came out of this. One was that when he allocated money to do an alternate system so that they wouldn't have to continue with Diebold, the part of the Congress flipped it so that instead they gave millions of dollars to Diebold for poll books. I'm not exactly sure what poll books are. I think that has to do with voter registration.
Right.
Instead of dealing with the whole ballot issue, they just evaded it altogether. And then there supposedly was something written in that said that for 2008, that the machines that were not certified now would be certified, the Diebold machines, which was disturbing. So that's one thing. And then another thing, because I'm in contact with an activist who sends me reports from the trenches, which I then post, from Maryland, and she said that one thing that was very disturbing is that Maryland is very close to Washington, D.C., and you certainly would have expected, especially the way this all played out, that the Democratic leadership could have definitely jumped in here. It would have been very very obvious logical thing to happen, and yet it did not, which brings me, again, to the whole business about, for instance, Howard Dean just came out. Did I read it in your column?
Yeah, I think I sent it to you. Yeah,
that was great about saying about the voting machines. Forget the voting machines.
Right.
But it's such a whisper, and it's so lost amidst the total silence of the Democratic leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what it's going to take for these guys to get that if they don't wake up, they have relegated themselves to permanent minority status.
I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take. You know, it may take them going into November this year, you know, leading in the polls, you know, 60-40, and then losing. And they'll be ready to spin that. Karl Rove will be ready to spin that, you know, with, it was the immigration debate, or it was once the voters were in the booth, they, you know, faced with their personal security, they realized they were safer with Republicans after all. And guess what? The Democrats are so stupid, they may just buy it again.
Last time it worked.
I know. It works, and they fall for it. But, you know, the numbers were nothing like they are now. So maybe that's what it'll take for them to go, hey, wait a minute. this time I'm not going to buy it, you know.
Yeah, but what happens?
Fool me three times. Shame on me.
Yeah, what happens in the meantime with more years of Republican domination? That's so scary to me.
You know, I don't know. I don't know. But you know, we'll see whether that happens. They may or may not. I don't know what's going to happen in November. There's no way of knowing. And the Democrats may take back one of the houses. They may take back both of the houses. Well, one of the ways that they can be stopped is because of you and me educating these people. I mean, did you have? You've been telling me, you know, points to this story that I had no idea about. I hadn't heard, you know, what had happened in the Maryland legislature. Now, 2 years ago, would you have known any of this stuff?
No.
You know, would you have known who would you be able to tell me who the election director of Leon County, Florida is? You know, people are educating themselves. The citizens are. They're doing it by themselves because, you know, the media ain't helping, the political parties ain't helping. They're educating themselves with the help of folks like you, and they are going out there and they're paying attention to now for the first time to the types of machines that you know, their counties are using. You can bet your bottom dollar they're going to be at the polls on election day. They're going to be there with video cameras. They're going to be there in the counting room. You know, they're going to be there afterwards checking out the numbers all over this thing. And that's the only thing right now that we have to protect us, is the vigilance of an educated citizenry. And believe me, they're doing a great job, the citizens are, in places all around this country. And a lot of these boards of elections, these election workers and these secretaries of state have no idea what's hitting them. You know, Jan Brewer, Secretary of State of Arizona, went out to make her announcement for her that she's, you know, running for re-election, and she was, the entire speech was interrupted by election integrity advocates who were out there yelling and screaming because she had just went ahead and certified these hackable Diebold machines. And, you know, they didn't want to let her get away with it. And that made it into the story because, you know, AP was out there to cover her stupid little re-election announcement. And they asked her, hey, what do you think about all these people who wouldn't even let you speak? You know, and she called them anarchists and conspiracy theorists. And I was delighted to pick up that story and tell the rest of the world what a jerk Jan Brewer was, you know, in calling people to give a damn about our democracy anarchists. So those are the people that are going to make the difference. Those are the people that are going to hold back this mess, the people like you and like me who are telling the story, who are getting out there on the ground and making it a hell of a lot harder for them to get away with it.
Well,
so we'll
how
see
are
who
we going to get more people caught up in this? In other words, it needs, you know, Malcolm Gladwell and the whole tipping point thing, where I agree that it's, I mean, I see just from, I've been doing the lending library thing since September, right?
Uh-huh.
So that's less than a year. It's a little over 6 months. I see a change from the amount of interest and if you walk around, et cetera. But it's still like a small drop in a very large bucket. So the question is, you know, we need to pick up the pace a little here, or it'll be 457 years until we actually can get enough of a critical mass to achieve change.
Well, I fear it's going to be a long fight, and I wish that there was a silver bullet that we could go out and change everything overnight.
No, I don't think there is something for. But what I'm saying is, I'm not envisioning that even by this election or even by 2008 that something can happen. But I'm saying, nevertheless, you need much more civic involvement, much more civic awareness. Howard Dean, in this stupid article, your article wasn't stupid, but he came out sounding like such an idiot when he made this asinine comment about, you know, it was some program and I hacked it, but I wasn't really sure if they just made it look like I had hacked it.
Yeah.
You know, what is that? Shows such a total lack of understanding of the machines and how they work, and that is unfortunately reflected in the man on the street. The man on the street does not have a clue about how these machines work.
Well, don't be, you know what, don't be so hard on the man on the street. Because
I'm not
blaming
him.
No, but I'm saying the man on the street is you, and the man on the street is me. And I wish we had an army, a velvet revolution, if you will, of, you know, folks out there with pitchforks and torches. But until we do, don't, quote, misunderestimate the importance of one person, because I have seen it over and over again. I know the effect that I've had as one person, and the effect that you've had, you know, in getting your stuff out at Op-Ed News and getting, you know, the film out via the lending library. I've seen my father, who never had a political bone in his body, and in fact voted for George W. Bush at least the first time, if I'm not mistaken, maybe even both times, now that I think about it. I'm told by folks in St. Louis County that it was he almost single-handedly who came in at the last second when St. Louis County was trying to decide what in Missouri, trying to decide what system they were going to use, and they were planning to use Diebold touchscreen machines. And he came in there to a public meeting and said, "No, wait a minute. Are you guys crazy? Look at this and this and this," and he had all this stuff printed out from Bradblog that I had reported that they weren't even aware of. And he got to know them and started faxing them material, and guess what? They decided to not go with Diebold. And some of the election integrity folks down in Missouri said, "Hey, Brad, it was seems to be your father who came in at the last minute and really turned the tide. And here's a guy who was not an activist, who was never political, but he bothered to speak up." And there's, you know, something like 3 million people in St. Louis. Mind you, they ended up going with ES&S because that was the other choice. Right. But but it made the point, and that's all he can do, and that's all you and I can do. But it does, one person can make a difference. One person can make a huge difference, like Ion Sancho.
Right.
You know? So don't be discouraged just because we don't have an orange revolution in the street yet. We may at some point, but you know, until then, we do have, you know, thousands, if not millions, of great patriots out there fighting the good fight. That's all that we can do.
Well, and the internet has certainly been crucial for this.
Yep.
I mean, 10 years ago, we would be 100 steps further behind.
We would be sending smoke signals
right.
to each other.
I was thinking in terms of the library project. I'd be licking stamps,
yep.
you know?
Yeah.
It would take me a thousand times longer.
Yeah. No, I know. That's absolutely right. So we're getting there. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, whether we win, whether we lose, we are fighting a good fight, and I can sleep well at night, at least when I finally am able to get
to
sleep. Yeah, exactly. But that's all we can do.
Cool. All right. Well, I think this is certainly enough for 87 articles.
Yeah, good luck to you.
So now what happens? You're going to send something to me?
I will send you an MP3 file with this entire conversation.
All right. Now, does that come to me via email?
I'll send it to you via email.
And I will be able to figure out how to open it up. Although I know who to call if I have problems.
That's right.
My teacher.
There you go.
You never were a teacher?
I was not a teacher.
Because you are wonderfully patient and explicating really well. In fact, Rob made me send to him your explanation because he wanted to know what you explained that he was unable to explain.
on how to link stuff or something?
Yeah, because he sent me stuff, but it wasn't clear. When you went through it with me and you did it via email also, it was clear. And I was able to get it.
Well, I've been a director, a theater director, so maybe that skill has also come in handy in these sorts of things.
Well, this is totally cool. I mean, I feel like a byproduct is I have much better grip on who you are and what you're doing.
Don't tell anyone.
So keep me in the loop. You know, I'm happy to always post what you got.
Thank you. And you're on the alert list. You get all of those, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So just keep using them however you can to make some damn noise.
Yeah, well.
That's all we can do is keep making noise.
Noise is what I make.
Good. Keep it up.
Well,
I'll send you this MP3. Yeah, if you have any problems, let me know. Otherwise, you know, do with it as you like, whether you want to, transcribe it or just, you know, pull information out of it for an article, anything you want. It's up to you. Go for it. You're the
wonderful.
Best.
A pleasure.
All right, Joan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talk
Bye-bye.
To you later. Bye.